I wanted to start out by giving you a profile of the community in which I live and work, Northern Manhattan. Very densely populated, 7.4 square miles. We have over 600,000 mostly African American and Latino residents. There's excess mortality from asthma, cancer, heart disease. There's a high rate of obesity, diabetes, and learning disabilities. We have multiple environmental exposures from a range of polluting facilities. We're in a non-attainment area for clean air standards, and EPA ranks us number one in cancer risk from air toxics. And of course, in East Harlem, we have the highest asthma rates in the nation. This is a GIS map that gives you an idea of Manhattan, and looking towards the little dotted line, separates Northern Manhattan from the rest. And you'll see the darker areas show the higher asthma rates in the city, in the borough. And the circles denote the polluting facilities. And you'll find that most of them are above the 96th Street line, where you've got two sewage treatment plants, five out of the six Manhattan bus depots are there, and a variety of other kinds of facilities. So we're an organization, we act for environmental justice, that within this context and health status, we work to build community power to improve environmental health and protection and policy in communities of a color. And we got started back in 1988 out of struggles around the North River sewage treatment plant siting and the numerous bus depots we have in our community. We run a variety of programs in environmental health and community-based research, government accountability, youth leadership, community organizing and sustainable development. And we have been part of the national environmental justice movement since its early beginning. When we talk about environmental racism and justice, what we're talking about is that millions of people live and work in polluted environments and bear the burden of pollution. Their exposure and health risks are greater, and a variety of studies have shown that race is the primary predictor of where a toxic waste site is likely to be located, and that secondarily, income is the predictor. And we believe that it's a human right for us all to be protected from environmental degradation. This is a cover of Environmental Health Perspectives that shows a family in a park adjacent to the stacks of the North River sewage treatment plant. This was the issue that galvanized our community and got WEACT involved and hundreds of community residents involved over an 8-year organizing campaign to fix that plant. And that's one of the real reasons we got very involved in science and environmental health research, because we knew that evidence-based campaigns certainly move policymakers and empower residents. We think science and technology is a great tool, and we believe that the lack of scientific literacy and information really contributes to the systemic exclusion of communities of color from decision making. So as a result of these community struggles around these facilities, the community began to demand health studies to assess what they were being exposed to in their neighborhoods. So we reached out to Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health and began a partnership which has lasted over the last 10 years. And we are looking to study the relationship between community-level environmental exposures and environmental health outcomes, and then translate those findings into policy change that creates some equity in environmental decision-making and in protection in our neighborhoods. So we have worked to build our partnership with methods that will truly engage academics and researchers in a dialogue and a relationship. We certainly know that the first level of environmental health literacy has got to be raising awareness. And so that's certainly what we have been doing over the last 10 years. In the early years, our methods were town hall meetings. We led local public outreach campaigns. We distributed fact sheets, went to health fairs, and began to let parents know what were the steps they could take to have a healthy home. We hosted community conferences, first time in New York City that community-level conferences were held on issues like asthma, lead poisoning, children's environmental health, and ethical issues of genomic research. This is a conference that we held in, 2004, on the ethics of genetic research. It was co-sponsored by NIEHS and EPA. And we had about 400 participants, and we were able to bring 60 environmental justice groups from around the country to come to this meeting and to spend a second day developing recommendations after they'd had the first day of education and information. It was a very, very exciting, meeting. We again held a first community conference on lead poisoning, looking at some of the politics that were keeping keeping the city council from passing more protective legislation. And it led to a six-year coalition effort to achieve better legislation at the city council level. We did that, and one of the key successes to that legislation being passed was the fact that we organized parents to meet with their city council legislators, to go to city council and testify. In the prior years, we had it had been mostly advocates, it had been docs flying in from around the country to testify, but we really found that local political leaders wanted to hear from their constituents, and so it was very powerful with our ability to educate parents about the issue and get them there to testify and tell their stories. So we have developed an environmental health and justice leadership training that has trained over 200 residents over the last, 5 or 6 years. And just to give you a sense of what that curricula looks like, we start out with an overview and principles of toxicology. We have a toxics and treasures tour, which we take people on throughout the community. It's about a two-hour tour, and we've also put that tour on a DVD, and it's on our website. Our second week, we focus on asthma and environment, air pollution and impacts on our health. We look at diesel exhaust and health, look at indoor air pollution, pesticides, talk about integrated pest management. Our fourth week, we look at housing and health in terms of mold and indoor air quality and lead poisoning. Week five is cancer in the environment, with an emphasis on solid waste management. That's been a very big issue in New York City. We've the mayor's just developed a new solid waste plan. And we end up by putting it all together, presenting visions of healthy communities. We break down the group of generally about 40 residents into small groups so that they can present their visions, they can have strong discussion, and then we have a six-hour Saturday session on community organizing, media training, how do you tell your story to the media, and environmental planning in their neighborhoods. So the training is based on Columbia's environmental science courses, and it uses popular education principles, introduces the basics of toxicology, risk assessment, and it provides really complex information to a range of folks in terms of education, literacy, and age. We give out a resource binder that has about 70 articles, fact sheets, maps, booklets, and we try to provide talking points to the participants so that they can go back and give some of these talks to their tenant association or church group. Now, we have evaluated, it's been very interesting working on evaluation with our participants. We do that after each session and then at the end of the entire training. And some of the things we found out are that the connection to the workshop presenters is very important. Some presentations are too academic, and so we've been able to know which ones those are and rectify that. People really valued small group discussions after each lecture where they could ask more questions and address issues that, you know, linked to problems they had in their lives. And we realized also that it was important to have a range of materials that touched on issues that people are likely to be experiencing again in their neighborhoods. This is one of the early classes that graduated. And then we've been able to look at our curriculum and refocus it depending on what groups we are going to meet with. We have refocused our training on healthy homes to our 40 or so community participants, but we've also been able to access some of this and target it to housing groups or tenant groups that may just want week one or week two. And so we've been able to refine the curriculum, survey community groups to see which issues they are most interested in, and provide smaller and shorter trainings. And so when we looked to refocus on healthy homes, we looked at, an overview. We certainly Safeway to rid pests is a real issue in New York City, where roaches and mice and vermin are rampant in some neighborhoods, and people are using pesticides to get rid of them. And of course, that exposure to pesticides is causing major problems for their children. So we look at asthma and mold, community organizing, air pollution, and environmental justice. So when we began to modify our trainings to reflect the evaluation, we began to work more closely with researchers on their lectures. So whenever we've done a conference with researchers or invite them to be a lecturer, we work with them on their PowerPoint to make sure that it's accessible, that if they're talking about complex health concepts, that they explain those, and that they use plain language as much as possible to make these very accessible to residents. We targeted an eighth grade level for the presentations to ensure that a range of people can access these. We've also had some junior high school students, teachers have brought them to the trainings as well. So we try to make sure that they're accessible. We cut down the number of topics. We expanded the time of the small group sessions. We increased the hands-on activities so that trainees could really learn how to apply the information to their everyday lives. And we trained prior graduates to be peer facilitators with the new trainees. And we found that that works very, very well. So we have, again, evolved methods to ensure effective trainings. We've added some things like an environmental justice history timeline that residents can add their own victories or their own events to that timeline to buy in and feel a part of that history. We share information on research and environmental justice projects that are funded by the NIHS in other states so that residents can connect their issues and concerns to those of others around the country, and also learn about some of those issues, some of which are quite different. And again, we added a requirement for the Toxic and Treasures Tour because it really connects residents with the issues. And it's amazing how people can walk by a facility every day and never really notice it or really know what it is. And so we've really found that the tour by community residents who've often lived there 30 and 40 years is still eye-opening for many of them. So we've also, in addition to our evaluations, did a focus group of prior graduates so we could confirm what we found through the surveys. And what we found were that the topics that affected them personally were the ones most relevant to them. And we found that an enormous number of people said that pesticide lectures were the most important for them. They said that they shared the mold video that we distributed with their friends. We're finding that mold is one of the number one housing complaints that we're receiving in New York City today. We also found that role-playing empowered them to speak up on issues and to talk to their doctor about some of these health concerns. And 2 months after the training, many of the participants were still able to recall the best presenters and to recall those dynamics. So they offered suggestions for how to improve what we were doing. They wanted the trainings, can you believe it, over a longer period of time. You generally think people, you know, want less time. This is already 6 weeks. So they wanted them longer. They wanted more time for small groups and discussion, more role playing. And they talked about the attitude of the presenter being really critical to accessibility of the information and how they relate it to the information. Wanted more time for Q&A, and again, wanted community organizing sessions on Saturdays. They felt those were very important. So we feel that there has been transformation in terms of the consciousness of many of our trainees. The training encouraged leaders to explore the environments in which they lived in a much deeper way than they had. It challenged them to understand their roles and responsibilities in creating a neighborhood that they want. It encouraged them to be more proactive in thinking about addressing some of the problems there. It also made them realize that they had a stake in it, that it wasn't simply waiting for government or waiting for someone else to fix the problem, that they could take action. And they are able to develop a plan to achieve that vision. And we started something called the Street Team, which is drawn from the pool of trainees, and they determine issues that they want to work on. And we've just gotten a small EPA grant for them to work on pests and garbage in their neighborhoods and to begin to meet with the Department of Sanitation and figure out a better way to manage our garbage and pests. So we believe that this method of training is transformative. We believe that participants have really found ways to incorporate the collective wisdom of the community through this information, that they've utilized personal observations and experiences to frame the discussion on relevant health and justice topics. We've identified various barriers to effecting change, and we recognize the inherent community power and wisdom that is in our communities. This is another method of communication with community residents. It's called the Uptown Eye. It's our community tabloid newspaper, and this was a cover story on a special issue on children's environmental health. It was also another medium of translating findings on diesel exhaust exposure to community residents. This is another page with Pat Kinney, an air pollution expert at Columbia, talking to a young child who he had delivered a time activity test to, and talking to him about diesel and asking him where he goes in the community on his way to school and his way to home to understand where some of the impacts could be coming from. Because in this particular study, we found that 75% of the high schoolers in the study had reduced lung function, even if they didn't go to school in a heavily trafficked area. Again, these are fact sheets for our Healthy Home campaign. Again, goals for our Healthy Homes training. And this is a citywide coalition we put together to translate some of the indoor air pollution findings from the Columbia Children's Center. And the goals are to organize and mobilize tenants to win safe housing, to illustrate the connection between poor quality housing and health, reduce the use of dangerous pesticides, and empower residents to respond to health risks. Through that, we've developed a Housing and Health Leadership Council of motivated residents that will identify and pursue policy change. We've developed a citywide network of organizations to share that information and resources, and we have been able to address some policy issues on a citywide scale. Certainly outcomes are training strengthens the capacity of residents and community-based organizations to know their rights. They've increased residents' level of engagement. And we have been able to, we've had two really strong outcomes lately. One is we have helped to initiate a statewide task force on mold, and also we have been able to bring the City Department of Health and the City Department of Housing together to streamline their guidelines around mold remediation. They both had differing guidelines, and we couldn't figure out why, and they knew it existed, and it confused everybody, so finally we got them all in the same room and got that taken care of. It's addressed. So some of our recent outcomes in terms of community-based participatory research, we've had our neighborhood street team investigate the availability of pesticides at 135 neighborhood stores. They worked with the Columbia Center to determine the effectiveness of the EPA ban on chlorpyrifos and diazinon several years ago. And so what they were doing was going back to the stores to ensure that these banned pesticides have been taken off the shelves, because we have found that 1, 2, and 3 years later, these banned pesticides are still there. We've also identified indoor air quality issues and, again, advocated for policy change. So the evaluation of our partnership by Meredith Minkler, a researcher at USC, she says that the partners' roles in creating awareness of and leading the fight for environmental justice and the reduction in health disparities around asthma has been widely recognized. She also goes on to say that asthma has become the primary disease in which people have pointed to social inequality and engaged in widespread political action. So we felt that we've had a successful partnership in helping to develop capacity of communities, and I'll just leave you with a parting shot of one of our neighborhoods in Central Harlem. Thank you.
Oh, did I say you were?
Yes, we've got some incredible community parks, and we have five historic districts that with beautiful landmarked homes. Many of them are on tour certain times of the year. So we felt that we didn't want to show people simply the failings in our community, because we have so much richness and history and culture. So we try to combine the things that people are proud of. Beautiful community gardens as well we have in our community. We've had six sessions. In some years, we've done two a year. They're pretty intensive and really requires a full-time person, because the recruitment and retention really requires a lot of effort. So we've graduated 2 to 250 people. And what was the other question? I'm sorry. Yes. We try to go to people who have a constituency. So tenant association leaders, community gardeners, church group leaders, people who are sort of self-defined. You know, if you walk into a neighborhood or you go into a building, there's always one or two people who are the go-to people. And somehow they find us and we find them. And we go to a variety of community meetings and let people know about the training, ask them to join. And so we've been able to recruit residents. We've also been able to recruit staff of community-based organizations, not only in Northern Manhattan, but in Brooklyn and the Bronx as well. Oh, we've had a couple of faith-based people, a couple of teachers, and they brought some of their junior high school students, nurses. Yes. Myth. We've been able to work with some of the doctors at Harlem Hospital really get this, and the Harlem Hospital docs work with, have appointments at Columbia, so many of them are also research clinicians and really understand these issues, which is a good thing. We've also in the past done grand rounds and tried to talk to residents about some of the impacts in the community that could be exacerbating some of the respiratory disease they're seeing. But as a lot of you know, it's very difficult to get docs in a room to talk to them about these issues. I do know that our partners at Columbia are beginning to do a little more of that, and we'll have to evaluate how successful that's been. But it is difficult for them to spend that time. And we realize that there's so few of us in this country who are environmentally literate. And even most physicians in school don't even have a required course on environment or environmental health. So it's clearly a problem we've got to address.
Last question.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly some researchers who are probably white, who don't live in the community, who are used to only presenting to other scientists, can exude those dynamics. And then there are some who make every effort to make their information accessible and to explain it really well. So it's really the feeling you get from that presenter. And are they really going all the way to try to make you understand what they're talking about? Do they show a passion for what they're talking about? There's some people who are just so passionate about the information they're giving you that you're just enthralled because of their passion. And they can really, present so well. So I think a lot of it was about whether the person was stiff, were they comfortable presenting to community residents and children, people with a broad spectrum of backgrounds. That's really what it is. How do you relate to the audience?